So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review way.
Too dark for me, you know.
What is it like?
It's like an investigation into someone who's been wrongly convicted of a murder.
Is it real or is it?
Yeah, it's real.
Oh,
it's real.
Okay.
So it's like it's heavy.
Oh, okay. Sounds like quality listening.
I know. I'm more interested in finding about wrestlers and past indiscretions. That's why I like the Colt Cabana podcast.
Well, you could do murders in wrestling, and
yeah, it's true. I read Wrestling Babylon. Well,
there you go.
Have you read that book?
There's a season for you. I've read that book. Yeah,
dark book.
That's the Ear of Mushnick one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's written quite a few. He wrote one on Jimmy Snuka and that murder. He's done one on concussions.
He did one on.
He contributed on Benoit, where it was like four of them that wrote the book. Greg Oliver was part of it.
I thought he did his own one too, or no?
Oh, he's done a few of his own.
Okay.
He wrote this great article. I think it was for Penthouse actually on the Von Erich family.
I remember reading that. I think that's in actually
That would be in there. That was in there. Yeah
they reprinted it.
Reprinted.
Yeah, that's a dark story.
Stocking stuffers.
For the kids. Holden's getting really into wrestling, but he has no conception of it.
Oh, stop him now. Stop him ahead of time.
I showed him some Chikara.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, it's like
that's fun. Fairly safe.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I'll show him like
show him the Ophidian portal.
Yeah, exactly. And like the slow motion, grenades and stuff like that. So he really enjoys that.
Well, let's not waste any time.
All right, let's jump on in.
Welcome. How you doing? I'm doing great. That's how we're going to start this.
Oh, that's
Jesus. We now have a podcast
no
host with a podcast host, and both want to start.
I know. Well, I'm filling in for Way. I was expecting the three-man booth today, so I thought I would just be here for the Damien Chirpins, but now I feel like I have to be the Wei Ting of this group.
Wei Ting has reluctantly passed on this week's show. He messaged me on the weekend and just said, Pollock, I just can't do this show. It's too damn long. I'm sorry. So unfortunately, Wei Ting is he's away today.
What are we going to do next week when all of a sudden he shows up on MLW and signs a contract with them?
Oh, my goodness. And
starts no-showing here. That's what happens in this world now.
Who knows? If he Lex Luger's us, that would be really unfortunate.
Actually, he'd have to go to, like, the Errol Hawani show because he'd have to go to MMA.
Oh, that's right.
No wrestling.
And then they would say, how can this wrestling host move over to MMA when he's never done an MMA show before?
But he has been training jiu-jitsu for a while, right?
He has been training.
So, you know.
It's not the same as podcasting.
I know.
It's different.
I don't know. He's probably pretty good at jiu-jitsu.
Can his body hold up to a whole day of show prep?
That's true. That's true.
Damien Abraham's here in studio. And I'm excited about this show. As lengthy as it was, Christ, that bell. I hate that bell. That's the right now bell.
I know. I'll move that
it's
away.
It's now an institution. I'm very excited because this, to me, you know how The Undertaker lost at WrestleMania? This is what this podcast is like for me because it was a very important show you and I did last time, but everyone knows it was a bad match that The Undertaker and Lesnar had. And you know Undertaker... That's one he wants a takeover. He wants a redo. You know, he's had a lot of good matches with that particular opponent, and the last one wasn't so good. And that's where I felt my performance was the last time you and I were here back in the summer.
We were distracted.
I was a zombie that day.
It was the TNA day.
That's right. It was the day after the TNA story broke with Spike TV. This was all the way back in July. And I think I had about 3 hours of sleep that night. And I had to deal with all this stuff in the morning, and I knew Damien was coming in. And you and I, we did the mistake now. Now we have learned we eat after the podcast, not before.
Yeah, because we were both sluggish afterwards.
I think so. Harvey's will do that to us. And I just thought you carried that show, in my opinion. Well, and I was just adding what I could, and I was not happy with myself during that show.
Well, no, I thought you were great, considering what you had been through. We were in
what,
for...
What were we reviewing on that show?
That was That was the North Korea New
Japan
show.
That's right. So sticking with New Japan.
Yeah, exactly. 90s New Japan.
We're just going back a year now.
Yeah, exactly. One year ago in a world away. And actually a universe away, because it was TNA had a major story, and now it's WWE, UFC having major stories. But we luckily
that's right.
put a buffer
this
day.
Time I made the smart call that after Saturday, I'm like, okay, I think Monday's going to be a busy day for me. And me and Damian decided we are going to move this to the normal time, Wednesday morning. This is live.
Which is great for me because I had the most insane 72-hour period of my life. Last week. I went to New York on Monday to actually theoretically meet up with Scott Kelly from the band Neurosis, who turns out is a huge wrestling fan and listens to The Law, so shout out to Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
I don't know if I didn't blow up your spot there, Scott, by revealing that you're a wrestling fan. Now you're going to be really annoyed at shows, maybe. But anyway, but he's a big wrestling fan. I was supposed to meet up with him. Was so tired getting in that I fell asleep.
You know what? You should thank him. We'll go out with...
A Neurosis song.
Let's do
it. Oh, absolutely.
That'd be awesome. That'll be his tribute.
Yeah, no, they are like a legendary band. Like, believe me, finding out that he likes wrestling was like
a
topper on an amazing cake. But anyway, I fell asleep and missed their whole show.
Oh, no.
Yeah, embarrassingly enough. And then had 3 days of kind of, or 2 days of kind of not doing too much, just hanging around New York trying to get some work done on the podcast. Then I was there for this crazy Vice party. I don't know if you heard about this thing.
Well, you told us the last time about a crazy Vice
this
party.
One's even...
The one here in, when you were here with Braden.
Yeah, that's right. That one. This.
I just realized I wasn't part of that show.
No.
I listened to that.
And also, I should apologize because I listened to the following NXT, and Jason Agnew sounded a little upset that I was dissing his music tastes.
Well, I'm sure.
I'm sorry.
He's never started What's Next with a fucked up song.
No, that's true.
So yeah, maybe he's true. Dissing your lifestyle.
I know. That's true. But I apologize. I wasn't trying to run you down, Jason, on that thing.
It's okay. I think he hates my music tastes as well.
I think all three of us could be a triumvirate of hatred of music tastes.
Did you enjoy? I don't know if you heard Review of Raw this week.
I've heard Review of Raw.
Nicki Minaj and Rihanna.
Well, that's
saying it's Raining Men, yeah. And I customized it because I was just looking for something. Sometimes I actively watch Raw now, and that's one of the top priorities is finding something and
the
then
segue song?
A song that works for it. And I think I struck gold with Chicago last week, but then this week. We had Roman Reigns, and it was after the show that I put it together. And here we have a song where she talks about caulking something and then making it rain. And I was like, this is the best I'm going to get, where I do that at probably 2:30 in the morning, and that's my brain function at that
level. I was hoping when I heard the Roman Reigns thing that the song, because I love those song segues, was going to be Rain in Blood by Slayer.
Oh, didn't even cross my mind.
Raining blood from a lacerated sky.
See, me and you, that's where our lifestyles differ, where mine, I'm thinking... Crying in the Rain, the dance song, Why Does It Always Rain on Me, It's Raining Men, which led to the more appropriate Nicki Minaj Rihanna version.
Well,
there's where we ended up.
I was thinking Millennial Rain, my band song, Millennial Rain.
Millennial Rain would have been great if we could have incorporated Vince McMahon's interview last week with a Roman Reigns comment, and that would have worked because Roman Reigns even mentioned the brass ring during his acceptance speech. So I fucked up.
Oh, there you go. This
is going to be a good one.
This is a good show.
This is a good start.
We're so good.
This
we didn't
definitely
eat today.
Our best start.
We played this crazy Vice party, and this thing was – the one in Toronto was cool. This one, they flew me down to perform. They flew in Steve McDonald from the band Off to play bass. Ben from they had a bunch of people come together for this hardcore band. Including John Joseph from the band The Cro-Mags, one of my favorite singers of all time. So I got a duet with him.
Kenny Florin's a huge fan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Kenny Florin reps Cro-Mags. I was actually asking John Joseph, because I know Bubba Ray Dudley will sometimes wear the New York City Hardcore X on his tape. And I'm like, yo, do you know this dude, Bubba Ray Dudley? Is he a hardcore dude? He's like, I have no idea. He's like, he's a big, fat, white dude. He's like, describes a lot of people. So, suffice to say, I don't know for sure if he's a hardcore dude or not. But he did mention Kenny Florian has rock Cro-Mag shirts and stuff
Yeah, it was just a random – like a UFC, they were running two straight nights. And then on the first night, they threw to John Anik and Kenny Florian at the site of the next night's show. So they're not all dressed up and ready for the broadcast. They're just kind of in their casual attire. And he's wearing a Cro-Mag shirt.
Shh, you repping the team. So John.
Feature podcast guest, Kenny Florian for you.
Oh, exactly. I'd love to have him on the show. And also John Joseph. So we hung out with John Joseph, got to do this thing. I had no idea what else was going to be going on. I knew we were going to be doing six songs. I had no idea who else was going to be performing. And then as we get closer to the event, we start hearing all these crazy names. And it turns out it's like Lil Wayne. There's like Scarlett Johansson sang a New Order song.
Oh, wow.
Jonah Hill sang a Drake song.
Jonah Hill?
Yeah. Dream performed, Action Bronson. There was like a metal supergroup. It was a really insane night, but I didn't go to sleep. Flew back to Toronto, hung out with the kids, went to play another show in Burlington, Ontario that night, drove back to Toronto, didn't get a lot of sleep that next night. So, you know, I need that buffer day too.
I can hear it in your voice as well.
Yeah, a little raspy, but you know what? I think it makes me sound a little sexier.
It works
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, a little more erotic.
We haven't had you on since you did officially launch the podcast. How's it going so far?
And, awesome.
And for those that haven't heard it yet, this isn't a wrestling podcast you're doing.
No.
It's just all dedicated to punk and kind of going into the entire kind of culture, lifestyle.
But there has been some crossover,
yes.
Actually. Meredith Graves, who was on last week, talked about – actually, before I get to that, it's called Turn It to Punk. It's each week I interview someone who at some point in their life listened to punk rock. Now, at this point in their life, has kind of gone on to do other things, maybe within punk rock, maybe completely removed from punk rock. But it's just about how that kind of listen to that music affected their life. And, you know, it does cross over to wrestling. Meredith Graves, who was on last week, was telling a story about meeting Booker T and RVD and how Mick Foley should be essential required reading for teenage boys and all these sorts of things. She's a really cool interview, but did bleed over there. Gerard from Matador talked about wrestling. Anytime I'm on with someone that I know likes wrestling, it's going to bleed over.
You kind of just open, nudge the door open and
yeah,
see if they're going to walk through.
Exactly. And there's a couple wrestlers that I really want to get on there. Robbie Brookside, you know.
Yeah. You've tried to get him on, I understand.
Oh, I'm going to try. I'm still hoping. Still hoping. I would love to have him on. I've never met in my life anybody that is so in tune musically with what I'm in tune with.
Yeah.
Like, if I was to play...
And how have you found that? How have you discovered his interest? This is all through Twitter?
All through Twitter. He sent me a message one day. I sent him a message back, and we started relaying back and forth. And then he started posting playlists of what he listens to on Twitter. And it's like, playlist would be like I was flipping through my section of my 7-inch bin, you know, just like, wow, like Infrared, into Ignition, into Infest, into your eyes are just completely glassed.
Oh, these are all on my iPad.
We should trade iPods one day.
Oh, it would be a culture shock.
It would be a culture shock for both of us.
Or a culture beat in my case.
We'd probably get a light on the podcast section though.
Maybe.
Yeah, we could probably jive in that section. But yeah, so he and I just jived on it. I'd love to have him on the podcast. There's like, you know,
you have the best outlet to kind of go for a guest like that, because I mean, I would never be able to get somebody in a role like a Robbie Brookside doing a wrestling show. It's never going to happen. But
yeah.
You're removed from the quote unquote wrestling shows, but you have the knowledge base that you can open up that conversation when you have a guy on.
Yeah, we'll
like
see
that.
We'll see if he's allowed on in the end, or see if Eric comes on. Because
as long as they don't find this, for instance, and see that Damien Abraham is associated here,
or read any tweets that I said critical of the product or anything like that.
Yeah.
But there's other guys, like, you know, there's people in punk bands that I know have worked as wrestlers. There's guys who have worked as wrestlers. Like, I think that's the fascinating thing about punk rock, is like you meet people that you never associate at all with punk rock. Like, you know, someone like Robbie Brookside is, you know, this professional wrestler, you know, one of the greatest small room wrestlers of all time, he's considered. And you know.
Do you ever read the book The Wrestling? Have you ever heard of
no.
that?
No.
It's
It's
all about the British wrestling scene.
Yeah.
And it's not even so much like a narrative look at British wrestling. It's just all these interviews compiled, much like that book on the history of Saturday Night
yeah.
Live and ESPN, where it's just
like
blocks of,
oh.
of story. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, like an oral history of it. And that I bought that book, I think, when I was 15 years old, and it would just be, you know, you go to the bookstore,
mm-hmm.
you check the wrestling
mm-hmm.
section. It's like, okay, I've seen all of this. And then that book I just found downtown. It was like one copy. I'm like, this is about pro wrestling, and it's about guys I've never heard of.
Yeah.
And it was my first exposure really to British wrestling, and it was the first time I really learned anything about Robbie Brookside, who was interviewed
yeah.
there and was just, you know, this phenom as a teenager at that time.
Well, it's crazy because, like, you know, he doesn't have any of the identifiers, like the tattoos, and he's not, you know, he doesn't wear it on his sleeve as some other, you know, not disparagingly I mean that, but like as other people do. You know, but he knows more about punk than anyone I've ever talked to. Like, it's crazy. Like, his knowledge depth and stuff. He'll, like, tweet at me bands that I've never heard of. And then same goes for wrestling. You know, like, you know, we were talking, you know, Scott Kelly, this guy from Neurosis, who, you know, is in one of the greatest, you know, dark punk metal bands of all time. Like, you know, like, huge band, huge in their importance and their influence. And he's this pro wrestling fan too. And like, you know, never shall the two worlds intersect, but they always intersect. You know, like the Dictators, one of the first punk bands on their first LP, have wrestling references, and the guitar player did a wrestling fanzine. And the lead singer of Vom used to write essays about pro wrestling and Rolling Stone. And like, there's all these sorts of like weird
essays. Yeah. Rolling Stone.
Yeah. What's his name? Richard Metzger. I can't remember his name, but he's the lead singer of Vom. He wrote lyrics for Blue Oyster Cult. And he wrote an essay about, I think it was WrestleMania, and I'm 90% sure it was for Rolling Stone. Now it's probably going to be for Cream, and I'll look like an idiot to someone.
I got one of the best Christmas presents years ago when Rolling Stone put out every single issue ever that they had done, and they put it on, like, these, like, CDs, like, to install on your computer.
Yeah.
So you could get, like, PDF files of every Rolling Stone. And I thought it was awesome, but at the same time, it was like, God, I don't want to, like, this was, like, pre-iPad and stuff. So I was like, man, I don't want to be grilled to my computer screen reading, you know, 40 years of Rolling Stone magazines at this time. But somewhere there, I bet you I could look that up if I found the issue.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Or I've got a collection of his essays at home I can lend you, too.
Oh, then look at that.
You don't have to get through those CDs anymore. But, it's funny. And actually,
they're in, like, the Damien Abraham safe.
Yeah, exactly. My little vault. Actually, you have a – one day you come over, we can flip through the zine library.
I've never been to the Abraham Estate.
Yeah, the estate. It's palatial. It's like Jim Cornette describes his house, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot smaller.
Lots of collectibles.
A lot of records. It'd be like a lot of records, a lot of zines.
Do you have like a room that's just dedicated to like all your...
We have like a library that would be our dining room, I think, in a house, like where you were supposed to be, that's now just full of zines and books. And then we have an office upstairs that Laura and I share that's like a bedroom that probably will have to be used for one of the kids' bedrooms eventually.
Yeah.
That is just full of records. And there's like two little desks surrounded by shelves of records that are, you know, tipping over top of you.
Yeah, that's my dream, having that room.
Oh.
You know, this is my room.
This is your room.
I'm close enough to home that this is essentially my room.
Well, you know what? I don't know why you guys undersell this room. You could make this sound as big as and as crazy as you want.
This is the legendary Review Away studio.
If these walls
which
could talk.
You had the opportunity to see our former studio.
Yep.
And that was
that was a little small.
A literal broom closet that we recorded that podcast out of.
I've actually seen a couple studios, and then the one time that we did with Nate Milton in the big live event main studio. In the fight studio. Remember when we were here that night?
Yes. We did
Jerry Lawler had the heart attack on air.
That's why the first time we ever showed up at TSN Radio and we walked into where we were broadcasting, it was just ridiculous. Like, think of like a miniature sports center set, and that's where we broadcast out of. It is beyond anyone's means for what a radio show needs.
You guys haven't put that up on the Instagram ever, have you?
I don't know if it's on the Instagram. We've certainly tweeted out photos.
Okay.
Next time. You can get a sense of it if you watch last year when we did that Christmas gift exchange and Way edited a video together of it. We did that inside the studio, so you can maybe get an idea.
Is that Asia Court where the TSN is? Is that what they call it?
It's
I've been there one time.
Scarborough.
I used to be part of the family, remember? I used to work in the company.
Oh, yeah, I hear.
Now I'm an independent contractor. Well, I was an independent contractor.
Just make sure no one put a no-compete clause on you, because independent contractors, you cannot put a no-compete on.
They haven't. I know. Apparently, I found that out from a podcast. Which leads me to Robbie Brookside, talking to a friend of mine, Chris Jericho, the other day, said him and him.
Do you want to just pick up that name?
Phil. Yeah, sorry. I just dropped it. Sorry, I was just picking up my phone, which also has his information he texted me to tell you about. Anyway, Chris Jericho, Robbie Brookside, here's the segue before John ruined it by pointing out my obvious name drop, which I was self-referentially dropping. John, thank you very much. Chris Jericho said that him and Robbie Brookside used to talk about punk versus metal all the time when they were wrestling in Germany together back in the day. You're not paying attention.
I'm getting this weird message.
I feel like way now. I feel like welcome because
I'm very bad at multitasking here. When someone contacts me about something,
yeah, as soon as I name drop Chris Jericho, well, I gotta say because I gotta promote the thing.
Promote.
Chris Jericho
this Sunday
is because
3 p.m.
this Sunday. The reason we were talking on the phone is because I'm doing an interview with him. I'm gonna be interviewing him live in person, and he's gonna be doing a book signing. And you can get autographs, and it's $75 for a photo and autograph. There's going to be a book signing, a live podcast hosted by myself.
Oh.
I know. It's going to be unbelievably entertaining for everyone, especially me. I'm really excited to do this. He and I have done podcasts before on the Danko Jones podcast.
Yep.
But I feel like coming off the CM Punk, interview on Colt Cabana. And
so you're interviewing
off
him.
I'm interviewing him.
That'll be fun.
About him. I think it'll probably be discussion.
There's going to be fan questions, too, I understand.
I think we're going to open up to some fan questions.
Oh, that'd be good. Me and Way are coming by.
You and Way are going to be there as well. It's going to be a fun time.
It should be a lot of fun.
I know. I'm really excited. This is actually going to be a really good time. It's out at Woodbridge, 3901 Highway 7, Woodbridge, Ontario. And that's right across the street from the Chapters and Indigo. You can check out woodbridgeheroes.ca for more information or info@woodbridgeheroes.ca. And, yeah, come out and check it out Sunday, December the 14th, starting at 3 p.m.
This is a man who knows how to promote.
Did I promote that well?
You did it very well.
I'm really bad at doing that kind of stuff. Like, I'm never good at plugging. I tried to do plugs today at the end of my podcast for myself, and I screwed them all up. Took multiple takes.
Sometimes it just feels weird. I feel at the end of people have dedicated an hour and a half to listening to me, and then my end is, well, listen to more.
I guess that's why, and it always bugged me when I hear it, but on like some of those big podcasts, they have those like canned plugs that they go to, mm-hmm. like where it seems like it's meant to be natural, but you can tell there's an audio change slightly, like, hey, it's your old pal JR here, and then the audio shifts slightly. I guess that's why you do canned plugs, because it's so difficult to do them over and over again each week. You just can them once.
You could do that. It certainly works.
What was I talking about, John?
You were talking about canned plugs.
Damn it!
And how you can.
I thought I caught you.
I was just taking a sip of coffee.
Well, yeah. You're texting with Way, I bet.
Like, I'm not. No.
When are you coming back? This guy's terrible.
No, this guy, when he's not here with a microphone,
he's not here.
He just ignores me. We're going to get into New Japan.
That was a long intro.
So?
I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's why we needed, like, I thought we were going to be the three team. You know what we need to do after hours?
I think, Wei, it's tough. I think when there's three of us, I mean, you and me are kind of, we kind of can dominate at times, I think. And he has to work his way in.
You know how you guys are a little loosey-goosey now on Monday Night Raw because of the ear.
What are you talking about?
I'm just talking, it's a free-flowing show. I'm saying one night we do a no-holds-barred podcast of three of us, and we'll just like all bring our I'll go to Iran, you guys can go to Moosehead Country wherever we're
Molson Canadian
to Canada land, and we will do this we will do it up.
Yeah, we could do that someday,
and that's
sure.
when we will review Hardcore Homecoming.
Oh, you had this desire to review Hardcore Homecoming
because you guys mentioned it on the show.
Well, I feel we were forcing at that point the Shane Douglas streak.
Yeah,
and the joy of Shane Douglas' streak was how organic it was and how coincidental it was each week that I felt once it became a thing, that it was time to end the thing.
And today we end it.
Well, we ended it. Shane Douglas was not a young boy at ringside.
Nope.
We did keep our eyes open for him in 1994.
Maybe he was watching the show on pay-per-view in 1994.
He could have been.
You should have called him to interview him about this show.
What did you think about Tatsumi Fujinami's performance with Hulk Hogan and Jinichiro Tenryu and Antonio Inoki meeting for the first time?
I'm the franchise.
Are you going to be watching Wrestle Kingdom in a couple of weeks?
I am definitely going to be watching Wrestle Kingdom in a couple of weeks. I had plans to watch the ROH pay-per-view, but I flew back. But Wrestle Kingdom, I've got like nothing scheduled. I'm going to go and watch it with some friends, and I'm really excited. Really, really excited for
it. What is the big draw for you?
I think it's actually finally just seeing it presented, marketed towards me. I know that sounds really lame because, like, you know, I have no problem watching subtitled movies or things like that. But I was even watching this show and being like, I'm missing a lot without the commentary being in English. Like, you know, it's still enjoyable, but the fact that there's going to be Jim Ross calling it. Like, I think any competent announce team would have sold me on seeing it on pay-per-view. But, you know, the fact that I can see it on terrestrial pay-per-view because I'm old and I don't know how to get my Roku box to work properly because it keeps lagging so much. So I know I can get it on my pay-per-view channel. I can watch it on my TV, and I know I can hear Jim Ross call it. It's like all the conveniences that I would need to push me to, you know, watch it as it comes up.
Are you going to watch it live or the Sunday night? Probably Sunday night.
Sunday night.
Yeah. I think pretty intense to watch it 2 till 6 a.m.
Well, no, I did pull some all-nighters this weekend, so I'm feeling pretty young these days.
I have a feeling.
Are you going to watch it live?
I'm definitely going to be watching the Jones-Cormier pay-per-view, which is going to wrap up around 1 a.m.
Oh, then you just go right into it.
Well, usually on a UFC pay-per-view night, I'm up pretty late anyway because I watch the press conference after. Then I usually do a post-show. And then it's going to be 2 a.m., and I imagine I'll start watching the New Japan show. I don't think I'm going to make it till 6 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm going to probably need a break in there. But it's going to be a great show.
Look at that
lineup. It looks excellent. I'm really stoked for Nakamura and Ibushi. I mean, Tanahashi and Okada is going to be great. And that four-way junior heavyweight tag match, I think is going to be outstanding.
I think it's cool that's the Fish and O'Reilly.
Red Dragon, Young Bucks, Forever Hooligans, and Time Splitters.
Yeah, I honestly think Kyle O'Reilly is my favorite wrestler right now. I think watching his face in the ring and just watching the way he works and stuff. And I think Red Dragon's such a cool tag team.
I think he's the best guy in Ring of Honor right now.
Yeah, I think he is
to me is the key member of that roster that I would be after from New Japan.
Yeah.
I think he's been so excellent this year.
Oh, he's amazing at work, but just like I could see him being like, you know, there's like wrestlers that are amazing workers and they're just not quote unquote commercial. Like there's bands that are amazing bands, but they're just not quote unquote commercial bands. I think he's a very commercial, amazing wrestler. Like I could see him crossing over to like a WWE or something like that because he just has that kind of like charisma.
Yeah. You look at where the ROH roster and you look at it, it's like, man, New Japan really wants to like beef up their junior heavyweight division. And you have a great pick of the litter with the ROH guys. If you guys can make that work with Adam Cole, with Kyle O'Reilly and a number of those guys that can segue well into their junior heavyweight division. And I think Kyle O'Reilly, he's been tremendous this year. I've loved Red Dragon. I just think that four-way tag match, provided they get time, and I really hope that gets, you know, your 15, 16 minutes, it should be tremendous.
Yeah, I'm sure they would give that time, right? Because they're bringing enough talent from over. Well, I guess it's because it's a lot of foreign talent. Maybe.
Well, it's interesting. At first, the concern was like with all of these matches and fitting it into a four-hour window.
Yeah.
Like look at this Tokyo Dome show.
Yeah.
This was over 4 hours
without
the main event.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to.
Really?
Did you watch the Inoki Tenryu match?
I watched the whole thing, yeah. You had to watch a separate than those
Inoki
two files?
Inoki Tenryu was not part of this, and I'll explain why.
When you're talking about it, I'm like, did I skip
no,
that?
No, that was the main event, and TV Asahi would not broadcast it because of issues with Antonio Inoki at that time. There were a number of issues going on, and they would not put him on their television. So the main event of the Tokyo Dome did not air. So I finished this, and I'm watching the time ticking down on the YouTube video. I'm like, man, they got to wrap this Hashimoto match up because there's still another match to go. And the video ends. And then I did my digging and found out, no, they'd never broadcast the Inoki Tenryu match. So I had to go watch this on New Japan World. So I will cover that match. Don't worry. But after this marathon show, I had to go for another fucking sprint afterwards.
It would have been, what, 4 hours and a half, right? At that point,
I mean,
5 hours? Because files were like...
They were each like 140.
One was 175. One was 145. I think. Actually.
Okay, so that's you're talking a lengthy amount of a show. And what they did was they took this full Tokyo Dome show match, and then they made two TV specials out of it.
And why is the first TV special called Part Two?
That I cannot answer. I'm assuming that one because I imagine that Part One was the first week that they aired because the matches are mixed up.
It's not like they go in chronological order.
I imagine that's why.
So where was the Hulk? Because I was like, wow, Hulk Hogan's. At first, I'm like, Hulk Hogan's got to be in the main event. And actually, the show I thought this was a different show where Hulk.
They had Choshu and Fujiwara headline one special, and then they had Hashimoto and Chono headline the other special.
Okay.
So they made two specials out of it. So if you think about it, it would be like NBC was going to broadcast WrestleMania over 2 weeks and they used the three-way with Daniel Bryan. Well, no, it would be as if they didn't air the three-way.
Yeah.
And then they used Taker and Lesnar as the main event on one special, and then they used what would have been the
Triple H versus Bryan. Like what
yeah, that's kind of weird because that was the opening match. But you get my drift. Yeah, like something else of substance, the Andre the Giant Battle Royal headlining the other. But that's not a good comparison.
But, I mean, when did Hulk Hogan – where was that – what was the position of the Hulk Hogan match on the card in the actual main – in the actual like run?
It was, I think, third from the top.
Wow.
I think it
– was there another show where he main evented in a tag team match where he does color – where he bleeds?
He was doing – he did a number of New Japan shows over that year period in 93. This would be his last appearance with New Japan. It was this show, and then he would pop up in WCW later that summer. So this was in between WWF and WCW for him when he was doing movies. He was doing Thunder in Paradise and got a sweetheart deal with New Japan to do select dates and beat Tatsumi Fujinami at the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah.
Which did not sell out. This Dome show did not sell out, and it was – kind of disappointing in that regard that here you had Hogan and you had Ricky Choshu's big return after he tore his Achilles tendon and they didn't sell out the Dome.
And they also like they're very like they kind of do less and less crowd shots as the night goes on when it's darker, which is weird. But in the beginning, they definitely are showing like it's empty.
Yeah.
Once, especially during the Liger Tiger Mask match when they're showing them on top of those like. I guess the crane and the Jumbotron, it looks empty around them.
But by Hashimoto and Chono, I mean, they showed some, like, it was by no means an empty dome.
Yeah,
I mean, there was tens of thousands. I would
have
guessed off the top of my head from the shots, probably 35 to 40 minimum.
You could even hear from Hogan doing the, what he's doing, the ear, the Hogan audience ear call thing. What is that called? What does he call that?
The ear call thing.
Okay, when he does that thing.
Cup the ear.
You can hear there's like a pretty loud audience out there and stuff too.
I loved watching Ed Leslie try to navigate the Japanese crowd for a reaction.
Yeah, and also he looks a lot like Shane McMahon.
Like Shane McMahon.
Like, I was looking at his face.
No, maybe. If you gave Shane McMahon a mullet, I'm trying to imagine it and put him in red and yellow, torn up pants.
Maybe because I already have a Photoshop that I made myself like that and on my computer, and that's why I think like that.
This is more reason why we have to go to the Abraham Estate one
day. No one should ever come there.
Well, let's get into this. We're not going to spend 5 hours reviewing this show. The undercard was kind of what it was. We started off with a tag team match. Akira Nogami and Takeya Iizuka, now known as Takashi Iizuka, and you would never know that these were the same human being if you saw the present version of Iizuka and the 1994 version of Iizuka. But at this time, they were the Jumping Jolly Jacks. Maybe the best tag name ever. Very much a spinoff of the Rockers. And Iizuka was 27 years old at the time, taking on Akitoshi Saito and Masashi Aoyagi. And this match, 14 minutes this thing went. Longer than you would assume for just kind of your standard opener here. Won't go through everything here, but lots of just heavy kicks to the chest, particularly from Aoyagi to Iizuka. The Jacks hit this double leg lock to Aoyagi as the referee stopped Saito from entering and then realized the double team by the babyfaces. Then there was a half crab applied by Nogami. Saito broke with multiple kicks to the chest. Saito hit this weak spinning heel kick to Iizuka. And then another half crab. More kicks from Aoyagi to the chest, just murdering him with these kicks. And then Iizuka suplexed Saito. Nogami splashed off the top for a two count, but then Nogami hit the high bridging German for the win at 14 minutes and 7 seconds.
The Jacks, I thought, worked incredibly evil for a good guy team.
Yes.
Like, they were just, like, doing double team maneuvers and, like, working behind the ref's back and just looked like bad guys. And the other thing is, why in Japan do they keep the hold locked in when they see the guy's tag team partner coming across the ring to kick them as hard as he can in their chest?
Because you just think, man, he's going to tap any second right now.
Keep it locked on, just, like, ready to take that kick to the chest.
Yeah. Not much to this opening match. It was kind of just there to open the show. They got some time.
Is there a faction with the purple kimonos?
Yeah, and you saw later they were, the name was like the Heisei, I can't remember the exact name off the top of my head, but kind of like a group of shooters, essentially.
Okay. It's weird in Japan how you have like so many under, like it's factions just seem to dominate so much of North American wrestling, and there's like such an undercard gimmick sometimes. And,
yeah. The whole faction, they wore all these like blue geese.
Oh, blue. Oh, were they blue? Okay. My computer screen looked kind of purple.
Yeah. Purplish, I guess. Blue. Super Strong Machine took on Tatsutoshi Goto.
I thought it was like Cameron vibes with the purple.
Yeah, maybe that was what they were going for.
Like,
I can't get
set
into their head. And
like,
maybe
Dipset. Sorry, I digress.
Goto here. More kicks to the chest.
Yeah,
here.
A lot
super,
of kicks.
Super Strong Machine. Just absorbing all of these kicks. He would come back with a series of chops. Went for a rear naked choke. Now remember on this, chokes are illegal. So when you would see a rear naked choke applied, the referee would just be furiously trying to break it, which we would see in the Inoki Tenryu match.
I thought the differences between referees too, between the first two matches was quite profound. Like the first match, the guy's very vocal throughout the whole match and like quite like almost like a part of it. And then this match, he's kind of silent.
Yeah, it would kind of vary throughout some of the matches and the involvement you would see there. Super Strong Machine blocked a suplex, hitting a bulldog, then hit a bridging German, got a two count, and then went for his bridging hammerlock suplex, which was the devil windmill suplex, but that got blocked. Machine then blocks another suplex, hits a diving headbutt off the top for a two count, but the referee rules it a three count at 8:54, and there was this extremely confused look on the face of Machine, which was impressive because this is a masked man, and even he looked dumbfounded by this and what happened. This looked like a mess up.
What was that? Was there a reason, you know? Or?
I don't know what the reason was. Sometimes that's an old tactic that when a guy's losing, he'll kick out at three and just kind of trying to save face. And I don't know if that was the instance or they just had the timing off. But this was clearly, I mean, this was the big spot to do the finish. You would think that would have been the three count. It wasn't like you're confusing, well, is this the finish or it was a diving headbutt. So I thought that would have been it. So awkward ending to this match.
Yeah.
Not off to a great start on this Tokyo Dome show, I don't think.
Well, I still think it's better than the North Korean show that we watched last time.
And we don't have Sonny Ono's analysis.
Yeah,
on this
exactly.
Either.
And actually, what
talk about these evil white men.
Yeah, when I was talking about the liking the announced team to be in English, that to be said, as long as it's not Sonny Ono, Eric Bischoff.
How did you like watching this show without English commentary? Did you get into the matches?
Yeah, I've watched it before, and you can definitely it almost becomes like I love Japanese hardcore, and I love like foreign music that where I don't understand the lyrics necessarily, but I think there's still like it almost serves as a pulsing kind of like rhythmic track the voice, and so you can kind of get into the tempo of the match based on how excited they're getting. Like you can tell like when something's coming up because they're building up in the excitement and things like that. You don't get the story across, obviously. But the same when you listen to those Japanese hardcore bands. You don't necessarily understand what they're singing about, but you get the energy of what they're singing about.
Yeah, I really like going back and watching these shows, especially ones I haven't seen at a time period when I wasn't following Japanese wrestling. Like, today I can follow all this, and it's like I'm watching all these shows, so you understand what the stories are. And here, it's very easy to just go down a rabbit hole. It's like, okay, what was this guy doing at this point that leads to this big blow-off match, and then you'll find out, okay, this is who these people are aligned with. This was the story at the time. And you just kind of learn all these little intricacies. And I find that fun with wrestling, when you can go back and you can just piece things together of where it all culminates at a big show like this.
I've always said, I was talking to Chris and WH about this on 2 years ago. There's got to be a book about Japanese wrestling eventually, because I would love to just read.
Written by WH Park.
It would be amazing. Yeah. And I think you should do a Kickstarter for it, because I think people would fund it, because especially now there's so much interest in it. And because it's so linear, it's not like, trying to read, if you were to do a shoot and a worked history, incorporate the two in Japanese wrestling, you could kind of see. You could actually see how it would work, whereas in North American wrestling, you couldn't do that. You'd have to pick one or the other.
I feel WH you can go to and be like, all right, what was the deal with Tatsutoshi Goto and the match he had with Super Strong Machine in 94? And without batting an eye,
he would just
have the backstory. Oh, it was a political finish, and he was trying to save his heat, and this was the real life problems going on at the time between these two, and then it led to the two showing up at a bar together, and one guy ordered this, and the guy said, yeah, you fucked up that order just like you fucked up the finish, and could just give you an encyclopedic history of Japanese wrestling.
Next time I'm in Japan, I'm going to take him to a death match and get him to tell me the story. You know Deathmatch, the Japanese wrestling bar in Japan?
No, I don't.
Yeah, it doesn't actually feature wrestling anymore. Now it's horror movies, but it's still called Deathmatch. And there's a couple wrestling videos within. It's just like decorated with all these videotapes. And I'm like, oh, look, Tiger Mask video. And the guy's like, yeah, we used to be a wrestling theme bar. Now we're a horror movie theme bar.
They've moved on.
I will take him there, and we will talk about Japanese wrestling.
It's like that old bar on Queen Street that was called Gorilla Monsoons.
Yeah.
And nothing to do with wrestling. Like, no. You went in, they did have a picture, I believe, of Gorilla Monsoon on the wall. And that was it. There was nothing wrestling to it. It was just called Gorilla Monsoons.
Well, like the record store Neurotica on Queen Street West, when you go in there and you're like, oh, are you guys named after that record by Red Cross, Neurotica? And the guy's like, no. Just coincidence.
Just a name. That's a it. Like, what a letdown. Tiger Mask. Oh, this was our next match. Mask versus Mask.
Yeah.
Jushin Thunder Liger, who was the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Champion at the time, but not defending the title on this Tokyo Dome show against Tiger Mask, this being the third version, Koji Kanemoto, following Satoru Sayama and Mitsuharu Misawa. So he would be the third incarnate of Tiger Mask. And these entrances.
Incredible.
I will challenge anybody, Pride, WWE, you find me an elaborate entrance like this. We see Tiger Mask on a crane.
Not in the same outfit that he would come out in. That's key to remember.
So the crane is then lifted up to the ceiling of the Tokyo Dome. And the Tiger Mask is up there. And I'm like, what's going to happen here? He jumps off the crane and takes, I'll be generous, and say minimum 100-foot drop onto a crash pad. I don't know what I'm watching. And then the real Tiger Mask walks out from the back.
Yeah.
And it was a stuntman who had just jumped off a fucking crane to announce the arrival of Tiger Mask.
So are we supposed to believe that this is Tiger Mask who jumps off the crane, gets down there, and then comes up for his entrance? Because why didn't they put him in the same outfit?
Well, maybe
they gave him a cape when he's on top of it.
Maybe
it
they came up with this entrance 20 minutes before. Yeah. Like, is that crane staying here all so long? Because if so, we have an idea.
Well, maybe he saw Jushin Liger. He heard about Jushin Liger's entrance next, and he's like, okay, I got to come up with something to top it.
So, yes, and that's what they tried to do. Then we got the stunt Jushin Liger standing above the giant, like, screen. Think like the Jumbotron at the Rogers Center. And he's on top of this screen. Smoke goes off. And then they cut to Liger coming out of the entranceway. I thought he was going to dive off of the screen, which he did not.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering if he was going to dive off the screen too. But he shot like smoke. And then once again, I'm like, did he teleport into the smoke? Are that what was supposed to have happen? But also when Tiger Mask was coming to the ring, he had another – at first I thought he had like a special fitting on the front of his mask. I'm like, oh, well, that looks pretty cool. But he's holding another Tiger Mask in his mouth, which then he whips at someone in the audience. Like not throws – not Bret Hitman Hart style, puts it on. Someone a Rey Mysterio style.
No,
puts
it whips
on.
It at him.
Whips at someone in the crowd.
It's a sign of respect.
He's the heel.
So the match begins. Long head scissors by Liger and Tiger. And, you know, very much a ground-based match to start. And that's always a difficult part with the junior heavyweights is doing that style in a big stadium. Sometimes it doesn't translate so well to working a stadium show. And wrestlers will talk about working a stadium show versus a small arena. It's very different. Kind of you're doing big, exaggerated visuals that are going to connect with a larger audience. And sometimes the junior heavyweights, they don't really lend themselves so well to a Tokyo Dome setting. And that's how it started off, but did build up after that. Tiger Mask landed on his feet from a moonsault off the top. Liger hit his rolling kapu kick and then a baseball slide to the floor. Tiger Mask then drop kicks him to the floor, hits a tope, and goes for a moonsault off the top and hits it in the ring, but lifts up Liger at the count of two. My second most hated spot other than the climbing the cage and then jumping back in.
I know, but I think those spots can work. I don't know because we don't know this. If it's a blood feud, like, if I'm fighting someone and I'm beating them up and, like, I want to kill them and I know I can do it in a sanctioned situation, I don't want to pin you, right? Like, you know, Way versus John on some of those heated beefs you guys have, there's no pinning in those fights.
Listen, if I had Way bludgeoned, I wouldn't even be thinking of going for a pinfall, much less having second thoughts about it once I got on top of him for the win.
I think we need the jiu-jitsu battle between you guys. Three-way dance, you guys and Punk.
Listen, with all due respect to myself, I have rolled with Way. The man would snap me like a twig. That dude's half guard, holy Christ. Like, his leg his leg strength is incredible. Like, it feels like a fucking, like, a tree that I'm trying to break a hold of when he has me in, like, a 93 guard. That's incredible.
That's why you're going to break out the GTS then.
Maybe. But you know what? He would probably grip my arm so much that as I tried to flee him off my shoulders, it would probably wreck my shoulder.
I like how you analyze my just throwaway pithy comment about how...
No, because I've thought of this, Damien. I think about these things.
That's why I think you might have a shot, John. Because you're like, this is the thing. The analyst versus the raw physical specimen.
Waiting is... I've got to work to that level.
It's like chess master over there.
Well, nonetheless, Tiger Mask lifted him up at 2 because he just couldn't get enough of this. So Liger comes back with a top rope Hurricane Rana, identified by the announcers as Frankensteiner, knowing who was in the back. And Liger hits a Liger bomb for a 2 count. Then they go onto the ramp, and Tiger Mask hits a cartwheel into a crossbody, climbs to the top, and trips off the top turnbuckle, landing badly on the ramp. And this is where things kind of fell apart. He then hits a missile dropkick back in the ring. There's a bridging German, a jumping reverse senton, and then misses a corkscrew off the top, and Liger recovers at this point and hits the shooting star press for the win at 14 minutes, 27 seconds. Liger's presented a trophy. Tiger Mask is forced to unmask, revealing Koji Kanemoto, throws the mask at Liger. Maybe that's the only way he knows how to deliver a mask. And Liger shakes his hand, raises it to the crowd, and doing the deal that even in defeat here, this is going to be hopefully the renewal of Koji Kanemoto now that he has his identity as his real, the real human and not a tiger under a mask.
I realized watching this match that my favorite counter for some sort of high impact move is a drop kick. Like if you fire a drop kick at someone when they're coming off the rope, it looks so awesome.
It can be very good, very effective.
They used that a few times in this match.
It was okay. Decent match. I think if you were to say, hey, Liger and Koji Kanemoto are going 15 minutes, you'd be like, cool, that sounds great. In 1994, that sounds excellent. It was fine, but nowhere near best match on the show, and kind of had that blown trip off the top rope, which is a tough spot to overcome.
In Japan, is it always like when the junior heavyweights are kind of underpushed, the heavyweights are pushed, and then vice versa? Is it always like that?
No, at this time, was when I believe like Liger was booking the junior heavyweight division, and they were kept separate for the most part. Okay. And you had your heavyweights, and then you had your junior heavyweights, and they went to great lengths to kind of just keep them completely separate.
No, I meant as far as focus from the company.
I think this was kind of the golden age of junior heavyweight, like 95 through, I would say, up until, you know, the late 90s. I mean, that was just a golden period for New Japan's junior heavyweight division. So it was a very strong division. You were, Pegasus Kid was going to be coming in at that point. You would have the J-Cup kickoff later this year. So this was, in 94, that was a period where the junior heavyweights in New Japan were in very high regard, maybe the peak for junior heavyweights in that promotion.
Okay, now that I've given the idiot's perspective, why then it is not better, John? Why is it not better, this match?
Why was this match not better? Well, booking division versus the actual match, very different things. we'll bring you back and we'll review the Skydiving J tournament or something like that.
I want to see that next.
Well, up next was a tag match. The Steiner brothers, while they were still under contract to the WWF, they were starting to, they were on the way out of the company, but they still had a few more months left, taking on Hiroshi Hase and Keiji Muto. And this match, this would be my choice for match of the show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this match too. And also, I'm glad I got to bring the Steiners back when I came back, because they were on the show last time too.
Oh, that's right. So we have a new streak now.
I know. The Steiners, Damien streak.
And you know what? The Steiners didn't do Hardcore Homecoming.
No, that's... So we can't review that. But I don't think they did the New Japan Super Junior tournament either at any point.
That's true. That's true. I don't think Scott's been a junior heavyweight for many, many decades.
Many decades. It's amazing in this how... I just love the look of Japanese wrestlers throughout the show, right? Like, it's just like a normal, like, athletic-looking human being. And then you see these American wrestlers, and it's always just so freakish.
Don't you dare say a crossword about the Jurassic powers.
Okay, I'm not going to say anything terrible about the Jurassic
powers. We will get to them. This match, the crowd was really pumped at the start of things. Scott and Hase just started wrestling on the mat at the beginning. Scott hit this double underhook suplex to Hase. All four are in. There were a pair of gorilla press slams by the Steiners, sending Muto and Hase to the floor. Scott is no-selling these chops from Hase. And then Muto suplexes Scott on the ramp, runs up the ramp, and just runs. Does like the 100-yard dash, hitting this big lariat. And then Hase does the same thing to Rick, I believe it was.
Yeah, it was cool because they were like using that. Ramp got used a lot in different spots, but I think it was kind of neat that they were like having to knock these big giants off their feet by using momentum.
We saw the Muto lock applied by Hase, interestingly enough, even though Muto was right there.
He's borrowing it.
Scott hit a dragon suplex to Hase. Muto comes in, goes for a key lock on the left arm of Rick, and then Rick just lifts him up and drops him, hits a belly-to-belly to Hase off the turnbuckle, and then Scott with a tilt-a-whirl slam. Scott yells, "He ain't getting up from this one!" And thus, he hit, for the, I believe, the first time ever, the Steiner screwdriver. One of the most dangerous moves in wrestling history. Essentially, a Falcon Arrow into a pile driver. But the pile driver, think of the style of pile driver Owen Hart gave Steve Austin at SummerSlam 97, where the legs are straight instead of just your feet are on the ground. You're elevating your legs, so your body is kind of at almost a 90-degree position with the head in between the legs.
It's like do they call it a sit-down pile driver, or is that different?
Yeah, think of that. It's how a man has not died from this is incredible. And why this wasn't the finish, I don't know either, because this crowd was in shock seeing this move delivered to Hiroshi Hase.
He doesn't still do this, right?
No.
Because I haven't seen him do this since I saw him.
This was not a move that was just brought out willy-nilly on the house show circuit in Augusta, Georgia some night when we wanted to pop the crowd. This spot, I can't imagine, and that's why I'm not a pro wrestler, ever hearing this move pitched to me and saying, yeah. Don't worry, brother, I'll protect you. I don't give a fuck. I would never be taking this thing. This thing looks insane.
Well, these guys must have been fairly trusted at this point in Japan.
Oh, they must have been extremely trustworthy for Hase to agree to a spot like this. So if I had to nitpick this match, I think that should have been the finish. It was just such a incredible-looking move, and no one should have been able to kick out of that, especially if this was the first time it was ever introduced. So the crowd is very much into the match after that spot, really picked them up. Hase will not go down from these lariats. Finally, Scott runs into a uranage. Two of them are hit by Hase. Scott kicks out. Then Hase holds up Scott as Muto hits a face crusher off the top. Hase with a bridging German for a two count. As Scott and Muto and then Rick, they're fighting on the floor. Muto hits a handspring back elbow into the corner to Scott. Hase then tackles Rick away, allowing Muto to hit his moonsault to Scott, getting a near fall. Scott comes back with a Frankensteiner out of nowhere, and then Hase is placed on the shoulders of Rick. Scott hits a DDT to him off the shoulders of Rick, and they finish up with the Steinerizer to Hase for the win. 20 minutes, 52 seconds, as Muto is too late to make the save, coming off the top rope. But a tremendous tag match.
Yeah, unbelievable. These guys are really like an incredible tag team. And I think Scott Steiner obviously went on to become like a great character, but he's like a really awesome wrestler. And that was even in the last time we saw him wrestle.
Yeah, it's, watching Scott Steiner in 1999 versus 1994, it's just amazing to watch. And it's not like Scott was a small guy at this point. It was incredible how athletic he was with the size he carried. I mean, he would get much bigger, but this was still incredible at this point in time in his career that he could pull off a lot of this.
Were they like super awesome collegiate wrestlers too at that point? Because it never really brought up as like, you know,
I mean, they wrestled. They weren't world class or anything like that. They weren't threatening for any Olympic spots.
It was just a gimmick.
But they did wrestle. Okay. So they took from that.
I could tell by their boots. They were wearing the University of Michigan colored boots.
Yes, and Rick Steiner not going to allow any cauliflower ear to take over. Then they showed a video on Ricky Choshu, and a big part of this dome show was built around his return. He had torn his Achilles tendon, and taking on Yoshiaki Fujiwara, who is a master of the Achilles lock. So, simple story here. This guy is going to try and ruin this man's Achilles once again. And Yoshiaki Fujiwara, he had been part of New Japan, one of their first graduates of their dojo, had then gone on to the UWF. When that folded, they formed Pro Wrestling Fujiwara Gumi. And then at this point in time, that promotion was somewhat struggling, so they were doing kind of co-promotions with New Japan. And New Japan was certainly very healthy at this point, and it was able to create a lot of interesting matches, especially with Fujiwara, who the Fujiwara armbar is named after. And Riki Choshu was someone that was booking at a time when Fujiwara was part of that contingent that left New Japan. So you kind of had that that kind of insider appeal to this kind of a match as well.
How much would that insider stuff be known, though, at that point?
It's hard to say. Like, I'm merely guessing at this point. That's an Ask WH Park 9 on Twitter question.
Okay.
And he'll write the chapter.
Okay.
Riki Choshu, Yoshiaki Fujiwara, background.
We need that book. I'm paying for the Kickstarter.
What I really liked about this, and this also applied to the main event with Inoki and Tenryu, was that this was presented as a fight. It was presented as like, this felt much more like a mixed martial arts fight than a pro wrestling main event, certainly by 2014 standards.
I think every match here, even the Tiger Mask, like for every style, like it felt like this is how you would do these moves in a real fight. Like this is what it would look like if you took a drop kick and what you would feel like, what you look like when you fell from a drop kick or something like that, or like fell from like one of these moves. Like it felt really real, like hard hitting.
Yeah. And you had a crowd that, I mean, they were very much emotionally invested here in Riki Choshu. You had a great story about his comeback. Fujiwara, early on in the match, mounts Choshu and just starts striking him on top, attempts for the armbar, but Choshu gets up, kicks at Fujiwara, he's not selling any of it, grabs the right leg of Choshu, and gets to the rope for the quick break, and I think anything you built around the leg was going to get heat from the audience. Choshu went for a lariat, it gets countered, and Fujiwara turns around for the armbar, and crowds are buzzing for the armbar as he tries for it, and Choshu immediately getting the rope break before it's applied. Fujiwara is stopping him in the corner, and then Choshu comes back with a lariat. Fujiwara won't go down from that. After three attempts, finally the fourth lariat takes him down and gets the pin at 9 minutes, 5 seconds, and that's the deal. Fujiwara kicks out at three, and I think that goes to the point of the guy just somewhat protecting himself by kicking out at three, and that might have been agreed upon. But I kind of like this, that here it was the big struggle for the lariat. He hit a fourth one, and it was just that cumulative damage where he was out from it, and it was just a different kind of a finish. You would never expect a lariat finish when the guy, outside of, a Stan Hansen or JBL where that was the finish. But here it was just this battle to take this guy down, and when he finally went down, he caught him.
And with Fujiwara, what happened to his head? I've always wondered that. He's got that streak.
That's maybe
a WH question.
The gym wars, perhaps.
Was it like something like that?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Anyway, yeah, it was a great.
You should have Fujiwara on your podcast.
Well, maybe he was into Bastard and Gizem and Tetsuari.
That's a great opening question.
That'd be an amazing first question. I wonder if there was a Japanese wrestler that was into Japanese hardcore. Some of that stuff's like legitimately terrifying, though. That world, like, there's this band from.
Give us an example here. What did you say? Terrifying.
There's this band from Japan called Gizem, and you're not supposed to mention their name.
Like, I think you've talked about them before.
Yeah.
Okay, but refresh.
If you Google Gizem Flamethrower on YouTube, you will see if you YouTube Gizem Flamethrower, you will see the lead singer, Sakevi of Gizem, spraying a flamethrower into the audience at a show.
Oh, wow.
It is insane.
In fairness, Conan brought a blowtorch out a few weeks ago on the show we reviewed.
That's true.
On that Genesis card.
That's true.
What was it? Genesis, I think, yes.
That's true. Well,
didn't ignite it on the crowd.
No, that's true. And also, though, to be fair, I'm less afraid of Conan than I am Sakevi. Sakevi also, like, I'm afraid of Conan, too.
But why are people not supposed to talk about them?
I don't know, because apparently if he hears that you're talking about him, he'll come and show up and find you. There's another one where he throws a saw into the crowd. It's a different world. We'll review one of their videos one day.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
You've scared me now.
We'll just say the band that can't be named every time we have to refer to them.
And then our first special ended here with the Choshu win, and they showed a video of him training, coming back from this Achilles tendon tear, and just highlights of the match we just saw. So that wrapped up part two, which was actually part one for us.
Yeah.
And now is the second part. We probably would have been fine with just reviewing half of this card.
We could have broken up, and then Way could have done a part, and I could have done a part.
You guys could have tagged in. It could have been like the Nitro broadcast.
I don't mind though. I'm like in awe. Like this is me listening to you in my bathroom, but now I'm watching you.
Wow.
Got a little
I'm flattered.
Real. Got a little real there.
You don't listen to yourself in the bathroom?
No, I've never listened to myself. I can't. I have to listen to it once through to like make sure there's like nothing insanely bad in the podcast.
How do you find interviewing people now that you're in that position right now where you have to lead a conversation? Are you?
I go to Cole Cabana. Like the Cole Cabana method is my method where you're just trying to have a conversation. You know, I've tried different methods. I've tried to have questions and stuff, and I find like
do you go in with notes or just specific topics you want to hit on?
Yeah, I think generally like hopefully I know the person well enough to know when they bring up a certain topic, if I want to go down that road, you know, like there's certain things that I'm like looking for every time, like them to bring up. But, you know, like I have next week on the show, I have Steve McDonald who tells this crazy story. But when he was 12 years old, playing in this band Red Cross, opening for Black Flag, getting kidnapped by his 24-year-old girlfriend. And it's just like, I had no idea that we were going to go down that road.
Yeah, sometimes you'll get something busted out on you, and it's really there's no appropriate follow up.
Well, he luckily like he's in a good place about the story. Like it wasn't like a moment where we had to end the interview or anything like that. But just like, wow, like, yeah, there's no real appropriate follow up to that other than that's a crazy story.
Do you listen to Howard Stern?
Not really, because I've
never listened to him up until the past month, and now I listen to quite a bit of him, and I think he's a fantastic interviewer.
I think I'm just too PC. You know, I think I just wouldn't be able to find the I find him just too, like, eh. Like
that's what everyone associates with him. But if you just watch him just conduct a normal interview, like I listened to one he did with Jon Stewart.
Yeah.
Another one with Katie Sagal from Sons of Anarchy. I mean, he's just a great interviewer.
Yeah.
And it's like he's perceived as just the guy that has porn stars on. But it's so, he's so much more beyond that.
Yeah. No, I know he's beyond just the porn star stuff. But even like... I don't know, just some of those questions, like, I don't know, I guess I'm just like, if he was to ask them about music, I'd probably listen to it, you know? Like, that's kind of what I want to find out. There's just specific things I want to find out about these people generally, and they all seem to rely, circle around music, or wrestling, or marijuana, or if they were a family member of mine, my family.
Sometimes it could encompass all three.
I know, when that happens, you have a podcast with me.
That's the goal.
I guess.
Did you see the series finale to Sons of Anarchy last night?
No, John. I'm with Court Bauer on Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, yeah, right.
I watched – no, they had me – I'm going to give – they had me until season three.
Oh, when they lost – season
– that's when
season three
Ireland.
Was the year in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
I thought that season sucked.
Oh,
it was by far
so
the weakest.
Yeah, yeah. And I also just like – it became like, who am I meant to be cheering for here? Like, who's the good guy? You know, and I know that people say the same thing about Breaking Bad, but I'm like – the story is the fall, and I guess that maybe this is the story of the fall of this guy, but I'm like...
I think Sons of Anarchy is the perfect example of how far you can go with a protagonist with asking that question. I mean, in Breaking Bad, it's like at the end of the day, here's a guy that's doing these horrible things, but it's the idea that he's going to be gone and he wants to leave his family in a secure place in life.
Exactly.
In Sons of Anarchy, it's... At the core of it, it's these characters that certainly have family in mind. I was going to say family values, but that would be not accurate. But, I mean, there is this community amongst them. But the ways in which they go about preserving this family are reprehensible.
Yeah, like, but I also,
there are horrendous acts committed by these people.
Yeah, and in Breaking Bad... it was like – it was always kind of been like – you always – they would always kind of give you that knowing nod that Walter White is a bad guy. You know, he's gone down a darker path.
Right.
Whereas in Sons of Anarchy, it was almost like the whole time – like it was like a Nike commercial for that handsome dude from Undeclared. Also, I love Undeclared so much that I don't think I can buy him as a biker when I still see him as the Australian exchange student in Undeclared.
Oh, that's right. I've only watched a couple episodes of Undeclared.
No, that ruined Sons of Anarchy for you because now you're never going to feel to.
I think a lot of those guys in Sons of Anarchy are going to have a difficult time transit. If like that was a breakout role for a lot of those guys. I mean, not Katie Sagal, not Ron Perlman, but outside of that, I mean, they're going to be especially for for Jax. I mean, he is now, that is him.
Yeah.
That's the character that you're
going to be associated
with. He's going to really have to work to get himself out of.
Well, I think he's good looking enough that he's going to find a way. You know, he's like the new Brad Pitt. You know, he's like a handsome, super rugged looking dude.
Yeah.
You know,
people are going to be blown away if they ever see his back without that tattoo on the back.
When it's all gone. I'd get that tattoo for real if I were him. I don't like, I guess also I just stopped liking, I like that show, The Nick.
You know, I haven't watched that yet.
I think it's really good because it's exciting. It's like, you know, kind of like upsetting, but it's not about murder. I think that was the thing about Sons of Anarchy. It's just like the body count was just so high.
It was after a certain point. Wow. This final season is
it's just like no one survives, I bet. Like, just like.
It's the final ride. I won't ruin anything.
I read a lot of books about bikers and stuff like that. I was like quite interested.
I'm fascinated by a lot of that stuff. Just having, you know, I already had kind of an interest in that culture. And then watching this show, it's kind of added interest to me.
I would never suggest like ever someone doing like a Canadian version of like Breaking Bad or something like that. But a Canadian version of Sons of Anarchy, I think, would be fascinating. Like in the same way they did The Bridge and The Tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And they did The Killing, you know? Like, I think you could do Sons of Anarchy, obviously different storylines, but set it in Quebec. Because, like, if you read about that biker war, holy jeez, that's way crazier than the stuff in California.
Yeah, Yves Levine, the MMA referee, he's written books about about
the biker war and stuff.
Yeah, like biker groups. And, yeah, he's done a lot of work on that stuff.
Yeah, it's a part of the culture in Quebec in a real, like, big way, you know.
Well, that was our unofficial intermission.
We got digressed.
Are you ready for part 1/2?
I'm ready.
We continue. And, you know, watching that first half, I didn't know. I thought it was just broken up into two parts. No, it was two shows. And I was fearful. Oh, my God. Did they edit out Ed Leslie?
No.
No, they did not. No. You were going to get your Ed Leslie fix. If you bought a ticket that day to watch the Battlefield card at the Tokyo Dome, you were going to see Brutus Beefcake in
sans
all his glory.
Shears. I couldn't guess you couldn't get Shears through customs.
Maybe that was a tough buy for them.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, we can get you whatever you want.
We got a crane.
Yeah, no gardening shears.
It started off with how many do we have here? A 10-man tag where one side was quite impressive in hindsight. Here you had in 1994. A young Manabu Nakanishi, a young Yuji Nagata, a young Satoshi Kojima, a not-so-young Osamu Kido, and El Samurai. That's a hell of a fucking five-man team in 1994 to watch. I mean, Nagata and Kojima would become giant stars, and Nakanishi would have his time. Won a G1 in his day. Still around now, barely mobile, but a lot more mobile back in 1994.
And El Samurai is my favorite mask.
El Samurai, great talent. Taking on the great Kabuki, Kengo Kimura, Michiyoshi Ohara, Shiro Koshinaka, and Kuniaki Kobayashi, who you might recognize does some broadcast work today for New Japan. Match went 12 minutes here.
And they're part of that faction.
Heisei Ishingun.
That's what it's called?
Yes, I had it noted here. They were all, of course, in the outfits here as part of that group.
Is that WH in front of me or is that John Pollock?
Sometimes it's hard to tell. Lots of fire from Kojima. I mean, this guy, you could look at this guy in 1994 and see he was going to be an incredible talent. Boston Crab applied by Samurai to Ohara, and then a half crab was applied by Nakanishi. Nagata came in with a rear naked choke on Ohara, but the referee tried to break it up. And then Ohara chokeslammed Nagata and would get the pin 12 minutes and 9 seconds. I think more than anything, this was a bit of a showcase for a number of their young talents to get on a big show and kind of expose them on this kind of a card. Not that they were unknowns at this point in time, but certainly not what they would become. And I just thought this was a cool match to watch in hindsight, especially seeing such a young Yuji Nagata, who is one of the best performers, I believe, in New Japan history, as is Kojima.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cool. You didn't have much to add to this 10-man, did you, really?
Well, it was. I had a good time.
It was cool to see him. There's not a whole lot to say about this. Way more to say about the next match. Brutus Beefcake with Jimmy Hart against Black Cat, Victor Marr.
This is the match where I also noticed how well mic'd the ring was and, like, just the sounds coming off the ring.
And how throwing one Ed Leslie was to this crowd just watching him.
Well, yeah, exactly. And how loud Jimmy Hart was through that megaphone.
That was awkward hearing Jimmy Hart just riling up Beefcake. Come on, baby.
Yeah, come on.
Beefcake comes out in his Mega Maniac red and yellow gear. Jimmy Hart is on the megaphone trying to distract Black Cat, which allows Beefcake to toss him to the floor and get the advantage. I didn't know if Beefcake was trying to work heel or babyface here. I don't even know what he was trying to do here.
I don't know if he's a package deal with Hogan. Like, did they want to book him, or they're like
something? I'm gonna go off the grid here and just make a wild assumption that when they were sitting down chatting with Hogan, hey, we'll bring you in, but you've got to be bringing Ed Leslie.
Like,
we've got to get this Black Cat match on there.
We want the barber. We need the barber.
Let me see if he's available. Beefcake tries to rile up the crowd. Black Cat drops him with a left hand, applies a Boston Crab. Beefcake tries to bite him. There were leg kicks by Black Cat. Pretty blistering, these leg kicks, Ed Leslie. And then goes for the sharpshooter. Beefcake gets out, hits the jumping knee, which he would later rechristen while he was the booty man as the high knee. The high knee.
High knee.
Get it. And Beefcake wins his one and I believe only Tokyo Dome match at 8 minutes and 6 seconds. I think the worst match of the two specials.
Black Cat looked legitimately frustrated at times.
Probably.
Like, he's just like the punches that he's not lacing in into his gut, and the Black Cat just looks, this is not my match.
Black Cat was a very, very popular guy amongst especially a lot of the foreigners that would come over. He was very tight with Chris Benoit. And that really came out when Black Cat passed away in 2006. He was part of a lot of close people to Benoit that passed away in that kind of year and a half prior to Benoit's that whole deal. Then we had one of the greatest teams, the Jurassic Powers, Scott Norton and Hercules Hernandez, the greatest look of two guys that if you just wanted to say pro wrestling in 1994, these two were it. Mullets that were just exquisite.
And Norton's kind of fallen. His stock's fallen a little bit from the previous show we reviewed where he was the champ, right? Didn't he have the belt at that point, Scott Norton?
Oh, at that point. I don't think he had the title at that point. He would become IWGP champion.
Yeah, but I thought he did that.
He would do great in New Japan. I can't remember where he was at that Korean show. But taking on the Hellraisers, Road Warrior Hawk and Kensuke Sasaki for the IWGP tag titles. And
where's Animal?
Animal at this point, this was at that weird time for Hawk and Animal where Animal had suffered that back injury. So he was kind of on the sidelines. But also Hawk, after that 92 SummerSlam, just walked out on the company. He just went AWOL and kind of left Animal hanging where he didn't have his partner to team with. And they kind of just went separate ways for a few years. Hawk would end up teaming with Sasaki. Animal, I think, mentally thought he was done. And then they would come back together in WCW in 96. So at this point, Hawk and Animal were...
not together.
Yeah, that team was doomed. Oof.
Well, this is actually, like, of all the incarnations that this team has gone through, this is probably the best other than the original team.
Yeah, Kensuke Sasaki here with the face paint and all.
Better than Heidenreich.
The Hellraisers, what a name. They played the national anthems as they did for the title matches for both Japan and the U.S. Hawk hit this top rope clothesline to Norton early on. Norton just pops right back up. There was a battle of strength between Hawk and Hercules, and then Norton and Sasaki are in. Norton won't go down from the lariats until the third one takes him down. Hawk is run back first into the post as the Jurassic Powers have the heat on him. They work over the lower back, bear hug by Hercules. Norton then applies one. Finally, Hawk lands a running shoulder block, and Hawk runs down the ramp and hits the shoulder tackle over the top into the ring. And then a double clothesline is hit off the top by Hawk. Sasaki comes in with a power slam to Hercules, hits a judo toss, and gets the pinfall at 12:47, and they are presented with the belts as the new IWGP tag champions. Not a stellar match, I'll put it that way. This was like a classic, like, 80s kind of big man match for the most part with Norton, Hercules, and Hawk.
I like the idea, though, you get a trophy.
Of course. This was a big accomplishment.
I know. In Japan, like, the trophy thing. I guess the Road Warriors were a really popular team in Japan because they just seemed like a really – like, I guess it wasn't just the Hellraisers being super popular.
They exported well, yes. But, man, the Jurassic Powers, like, these were just, you know, your classic pro wrestlers that you knew had the Zubaz.
And yep.
The fanny packs, the mullets. God.
Yeah, like I got a pair of...
These look like the real life, you know, Sex Fergusons.
They look like they might smell bad, too.
Debatable. I can't speak for them at this time. But and a great name. Like, the names of Japanese tag teams are just phenomenal. And Jurassic Powers is one of them. Like,
well, I guess, you know, Jurassic
the,
Park
the Miracle Violence
out.
Connection. The Jurassic Powers. I just thought great name for these guys.
The Jacks, too.
The Jumping Jolly Jacks. I don't know if it's in that same stratosphere, but just great names that they would come up with for some of these. Much like the show names, they were tremendous. Next up, it was Hulk Hogan, his swan song in New Japan Pro Wrestling. Don't think he'll be coming back to New Japan anytime soon.
Well, maybe in some sort of managerial capacity.
Maybe he'll be a guest general manager.
Where was he working when he got the Jeff Jarrett guitar shot?
Oh, that's right. They had set up the angle for him to... Oh, that's... You know what? I'm incorrect. He worked Chono on that Tokyo Dome show in 2003. This was not Hogan's final Tokyo Dome match. He did the match with Chono, and then they did that angle with Jarrett that got replayed on TNA television for years and years.
So... probably going to be the opening shot on the new Discovery
and that
America
was network. They totally believed Hogan was coming in to work with Jarrett for TNA, and then lo and behold, he didn't. But so, that was back in 2003, so yeah, he would work with New Japan again.
Also, everyone listening, I got one over finally on John.
Man, boom. Damian Abraham.
Boom.
Tatsumi Fujinami was the man in there to get a match out of Hogan, and big reaction for Hogan coming out with Jimmy Hart. They obeyed the code of honor before the match. And then Fujinami applied a headlock. Hogan with a back suplex. That does not break the hold. Hogan goes for an armbar. And then with the Kimura grip, teaching us a thing or two, and applies a head scissors on Fujinami. I mean, this was Hulk Hogan just doing his basic wrestling to make a match out of this. Crowd seemed kind of indifferent to the match. Hogan hit a boot to the gut, scoop slam, but then misses the leg drop coming off the ropes. And Fujinami kicks at the left leg. Hogan with the heiny, and then clotheslines him over the top to the ramp, gets the crowd going, misses a lariat, takes one back over the top into the ring, and then Fujinami goes to the top, hits a flying knee, gets a two count, sharpshooter is applied, Hogan gets the rope break, rear naked choke is applied by Fujinami, transitions into a dragon sleeper, which Hogan escapes, and then hits a clothesline in the corner, and his finish, the axe bomber, which is essentially... a lariat, and gets the win at 13:34, and they shook hands after the match with Hogan raising Fujinami's arm.
Hulk Hogan was the heel, obviously, in this match, working a little bit heel, no?
Maybe a little bit. I don't think it was really defined as such. It just seemed like it was, you know, two kind of legendary figures to this audience having a somewhat dream match.
Yeah, okay, because it just seemed like the audience at first was not that excited about him, but every time he did, like when he walked in the ring, they exploded for him. It just didn't seem like the reaction was as sustained as some of the bigger...
Yeah, it's hard, you know, not being, you know, following the scene at the time, just watching this, it didn't feel like this was a huge deal. Mm-hmm. Like, Hulk Hogan in New Japan, it wasn't like this was his first time in. It was, you know, it was a big show match, but it just didn't feel like, you know, a giant attraction. It just was kind of what it was. Shinya Hashimoto and Masahiro Chono, two members of the famed Three Musketeers, facing off for the IWGP title, with Hashimoto defending the title. And this, too, kind of presented like this big fight feel, with a standoff at the start as they exchange strikes, and Hashimoto sneaking in a headbutt at a rope break in the corner, and then going after the left leg of Chono. There was a half crab. I thought a very kind of standard start to this match. You were waiting for that moment where it was going to pick up to the next level, and there were points in the match where it did elevate to the crowd, and they got into certain things. But for the most part, I thought this match went way too long.
Way long.
And I thought there was a lot of, especially in the first 15 minutes, where it just felt like this was not working. This wasn't clicking with the crowd.
It was just like plodding and slow and really stiff, which was great, but then it just went on and on.
Yeah, Hashimoto took a lot of the first three quarters of this match, lots of kicks to the chest. Eventually Chono would come back. He hit a Samoan drop, half crab, into the STF, which was his big submission, into a choke, and the referee tries to break that. Hashimoto escapes. He got his nose bloodied up at a point in this exchange. And then Hashimoto catches him with a judo toss, landing on his shoulder. Chono comes back with a leg submission and into the STF again. Then that's escaped by Hashimoto. Chono runs into a drop kick. There's a leg sweep into a knee bar. Hashimoto lifts him up, and then Chono goes for a small package as a counter, getting a two count that the crowd reacted to. And then Hashimoto hit a jumping enziguri, a spinning heel kick, and then finally hits the brain buster. But Chono kicks out of that to a huge reaction, and Hashimoto finally gets the win with a jumping DDT. 28 minutes. I think just too long.
Yeah,
for this crowd, this late in the show, and you had a legitimate dream match coming up next. That sometimes when you have such a big attraction in the main event, it can hurt the undercard because you just want to get to the big reason you came here for. And that, to me, just kind of guessing at the mentality of this crowd. But this one just not a legendary IWGP title match.
When I thought it was the main event, I was surprised that this was the crowd reaction to it. But now that I know it's not actually the main event, I'm not as surprised.
Well, I knew what was coming, and I'm looking at my thing. I'm just like, they got to wrap this up. So I thought this match was going to be ending around the 15-minute mark.
Yeah.
And no, it went 28 minutes. And then I had to do some digging and found out why the hell didn't this Inoki match air, and thus the background story.
So before you go into this, with New Japan World, what's the interface like with this new with the Japanese version?
Oh, man.
Is it easy to get around?
It's awesome. Like, it's a great service. It's especially if you have Google Chrome and that extension, you can translate the pages. Very easy to search. You can search by the wrestler, by event. And I just quickly looked this up, found the match right away. It just had Battlefield 94 with all the matches listed. You click on the match you want. And the player, it's pretty much verbatim what the YouTube player is. And you can just navigate it. And another cool thing that it's a nitpicky thing, but I hate watching matches on YouTube where you'll have that timer. It's like, I like watching a match where I don't have a timer that's counting down to how long this match is going to go. I like to just watch it, and you don't know where the finish is coming, certain points of the match. And the timer just disappears on this. You can just watch it plain as a normal match. It's a great player. It's a simple service to figure out, and I haven't had any issues with it.
Is the English one still coming, you know, or?
I think so. I think that's the plan, to have an English site, because I think you're really just hurting yourself not to have an English. There's such a demand,
especially,
I think,
now.
And to grow that English audience, you want to make it as easy as possible.
Because I got to wait for that, because I don't have a Google Chromecast. I got one of those Roku.
You don't need the Chromecast. You just need the Chrome
extension.
Yeah, but
I have to watch it on my computer, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I want to watch it. Like, as I said earlier, when me and the New Japan pay-per-view, I'm old.
Yeah.
I don't want to have those old time conveniences.
Well, fair enough.
Also, I think because growing up, I didn't have pay-per-view access. My parents never had the box, so I could never.
Yeah, neither did I. Neither did I. When did you get pay-per-view?
Probably when I moved out into my own.
Yeah.
Got my own thing. But then by that point, I had friends that were taping stuff for me, too. So I had a friend that had this crazy satellite thing, but that they jammed.
They had the infamous black box.
It was even crazier than a black box. It was like some sort of like American satellite dish that got like random, because that's where he got like New Japan tapes,
right.
AAA and all this sort of stuff.
Well, I'll quickly go through this because Damien, unfortunately, didn't get to see this. But Inoki and Tenryu, I will say this. This had the best atmosphere of any of this match, of the matches on this card. This was the main event to this crowd. They were fucking buzzing for this. Tenryu, at the time, he had, of course, he had the sumo background, had been a star in All Japan, then had formed War. And at this point, was coming over to New Japan and doing a lot of dream matches, and was presented as a big deal. And you got all these fresh matches with Tenryu, who was a star to the public. And this was the first match between Antonio Inoki and Tenryu. So the match starts, big burst of strikes from Inoki. Crowd erupts for this. Tenryu is slapping him back, catches him with a kick to the head. Inoki then hits a palm strike to the face and an enziguri, and goes for the rear naked choke, which is broken up by the official. And this was awesome. Tenryu was like out cold on the mat, but his foot was under the rope, and the referee couldn't stop the match. Tenryu sold that he was out for a good 3 to 4 minutes. Eyes closed. His team from War is all trying to revive him. Even Riki Choshu, who is there on New Japan's behalf, slaps him to try and wake him up. This was awesome. And finally, he's groggy. He gets to his feet. He's somewhat out of it. If this was a mixed martial arts fight, this would have been stopped. But it's pro wrestling, and the man has to be beaten. So Tanaru gets up. He's continuing in the match. He fires up with slaps, but then after hitting this flurry, he starts stumbling, still selling the effects of this choke. He takes another enziguri. Tenryu hits a lariat. Both men are down selling. Inoki then applies the octopus submission. Tenryu counters that. Inoki goes for an armbar. Tenryu gets the rope break. And then Tenryu hits these knees to the face, chops. Inoki with a rolling kapu kick gets the rear naked choke again, but the referee breaks the hold and again selling it big. They go back and forth with strikes. Tenryu hits a kick to the head and then stacks Inoki with a power bomb and gets the win at 15:57. And Inoki, after getting pinned, like sometimes you'll watch in an MMA fight where a guy gets knocked out and the referee stops the fight and the fighter that's taking the damage will just instinctively go for the leg of the referee or go for his opponent. That's like what Inoki did. He was so stunned, he just, out of the stack position, just went to like dive at Tenryu. And it was just, the presentation of this was so cool to watch. And Tenryu wins. And afterwards, Tenryu and his team from War, they're celebrating. They shake hands. Tenryu bows to Inoki. And then there's a back and forth exchange on the microphone. So I had to go look this up to find out what exactly was said here. So apparently Tenryu thanks Antonio Inoki for the match, offers him a rematch, but understands you have such a busy schedule. I hope you can make time for us to have a rematch one day. And Antonio Inoki responds, "Why, yes, I am very busy, and I don't know if I will have time for a wrestling match with you again." What a dick.
Yep.
But this, I would definitely recommend going back. The tag match was great, but in terms of creating a huge match that people were into, that was presented as a dream match, a dream scenario, this is really a match to go out of your way to watch. So get New Japan World.
I'm going to get it. Yeah, I'm going to, like, I think that's actually now trumped the WWE Network as the thing I'm going to get when I get.
I think you could just go nuts watching. And it's just because it's so different.
Exactly.
And a different idea of how a main event in pro wrestling can be presented and how an audience takes to it, as these are real guys. Mm-hmm. And it's very much what they've tried to do with Lesnar, I think. And it, I think, can still be done. And just to have a different look at how a main event on a wrestling show can be presented, Inoki Tenryu is really cool to watch.
I think that's the thing, you know, and to bring it back to that Punk stuff we were talking about, that's the great thing about pro wrestling, is that you can construct an incredible match out of this guy that's kind of on his way out and a young guy, whereas with CM Punk, are you going to be able to construct that amazing match in UFC?
So what did you think overall of the Tokyo Dome show?
I liked it. You know, like I'm more and more I get exposed to Japanese wrestling, the more intrigued I am by different guys and finding out different stuff. I'm by no way an expert in any way, shape, or form. So every exposure I enjoy. Yeah, I think the tag match was probably my favorite match, and not seeing the main event. But even then, I was like, I liked watching Tiger Mask get demasked and things like
and
that.
And jumping off a crane. How often
amazing.
Do you get that on a wrestling show?
Very rarely.
So, yeah, I thought this was not one of the better New Japan shows you're going to see. There was a lot of, you know, just stuff on the undercard that's not going to really register past watching it on first viewing. But the main event was really something intriguing to watch, and the tag match was great,
oh, yeah.
I thought. So those were two of the big highlights
and
of the show.
And a 10-way in the first match in the second card.
Oh yes, yeah, the 10-man tag.
It was
yeah.
fun too.
Yeah, it was a fun 10-man tag. So there you go, Battlefield 1994. It's very easy to watch on YouTube, minus Inoki and Tenryu. You're going to have to get New Japan World for
that's
that.
The gimmick to get you to get New Japan World. That's why they haven't pulled that video.
There you go. TV Asahi thinking way back then that, hey, we're going to be in partnership with these guys for a over-the-top service 20 years from now. We got to hold off on this
hold
main
this
event.
One. We've got to get them. This is the incentive. This
okay.
is the Vince podcast of the New Japan World.
Yeah, those guys just
hold it back.
What would the term be? These Generation Xers. They just
Generation Y.
We're going to go to some feedback now from the message board. I think we have some questions as well for Damien in here, which we will get to. Rob from Saskatoon writes in, When you have a card with double-digit matches on it, you're going to get a mixed bag. Some good, some bad. That's what this card was. Beefcake was apparently getting paid by the elbow, as he threw more in this match than all of his other matches combined. Liger and Tiger Mask was good, but I had very high expectations going in, and I was thinking it would be better. Hogan wrestled a different style in Japan than he did in North America. He had to work a more mat-based style. While not great, it was certainly passable. Any match where Inoki loses is a big deal, and I'm still surprised that a non-New Japan guy was allowed to beat Inoki on the biggest show of the year. Last Black Friday, I bought a whole bunch of January 4th Tokyo Dome shows online. These versions were the ones that aired on Japanese television afterwards and include the commercials. Japanese commercials in the mid-90s were some crazy shit. Way more entertaining than the matches on this card. I don't doubt it. That would be cool to watch was the commercials.
I used to work at a video store and we used to get this. We had this tape called Japanorama Volume 1, 2, and 3, and it was just collections of Japanese 90s commercials. And they are some incredible commercials.
That's fantastic. I guess I'll just keep going here.
Yeah.
Ryan from Calgary. This was the first Japanese wrestling card I had ever seen all the way through, and I'm glad that YouTube gives the option of speeding things up a bit. I've seen a few Japanese language versions of Pride shows, and I found this experience to be similar. I enjoyed the in-ring quite a bit, with the notable exception of the Steiner brothers attempting to murder Hase and Muto. Like Rob, I thought Hogan looked passable in this more technical match, though not great. 6 neck injuries out of 10. I'm holding out for the full internet version of the WWE Network to be available in Canada, and I don't get cable to watch the current product, so I'm usually restricted to watching what is available online. When you guys do these reviews, I can almost always find the shows you are doing in a given week, but is that something you consider when you are deciding what to review? Thanks for putting the work in. RIP Shane Douglas streak. Yeah, we try to pick shows that are going to be accessible to the most amount of people. That's what we found. Sometimes when we've picked shows where they're very obscure, you know, we like to hear thoughts from people.
Like when I made you guys watch I Like to Hurt People.
No, isn't I Like to Hurt People? We found that online.
Yeah,
didn't
no. I know. Didn't Mouth give it to you?
Oh, he might have, but I think.
And then someone found it online.
Yeah, maybe that's right.
That was it. Because I think Mouth, I think Mouth was on that one even too.
Yeah. But sometimes, I mean, it's also fun to just go back and find something that's so obscure that is worth chatting about.
Yep.
So it depends. We don't really have a formula to all of this.
Like when we review Way's Backyard Wrestling Tape.
Yeah, one day. But Joe and Necro Butcher, I mean, that event was pretty hard to find. Maybe the match not so much, but I'm really glad we reviewed that.
Absolutely.
I love doing different things. I mean, I like to get out of the routine of doing a WWE show.
Well, especially right now, it's just like the North American product is so homogeneous beyond a certain point, right? And it's just like to see that there's like, oh, it's such a wide world in wrestling. It's such a bizarrely strange, broad art form.
That's what I love doing. I love going and watching different I love watching Inoki and Tenryu. It's like, this is all pro wrestling.
I think you guys should do a Chikara show one week.
Yeah, we should.
A Chikara or because you did the Kaiju Big Battle. Did you do a show? No, you just talked
about it. We went to it over WrestleMania weekend.
Because there's the videos, which they have like little narratives kind of worked into. They're very watchable, the Kaiju Big Battle DVDs.
Mohan from Hong Kong. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Although this was a solid card, I only found a few matches good to great, and the rest were just above average. It's hard to believe that one of the Jumping Jolly Jacks is the crazy guy teaming with Minoru Suzuki now. Tiger Mask versus Liger was not as great as other matches Kanemoto would have with Liger in 96 and 97. The botch felt weird, and so did the sudden ending coming out of nowhere where Liger used one of his last shooting star presses. What was even more weird, to see Hogan do some real wrestling. However, in my opinion, this finisher was better than the leg drop. I think in hindsight, Hogan would have much rather have gone with the axe bomber than the leg drop.
Yeah.
Doing that every night of the week.
It's funny because isn't there that video I can't remember who's some old time wrestler is making fun of Hulk Hogan for having the leg drop as his finishing move?
Vern Gagne, I think.
Yeah, and it's just like, well, that actually was a pretty painful move in the end.
Oh, yeah.
All parties involved.
I think he would be the first to regret doing that leg drop. The Inoki match was amazing, with Inoki coming off as desperate for a win and being outmatched by Tenryu. Also, this match was really significant as it made Tenryu the only wrestler to ever beat Inoki and Giant Baba. Randy in Australia, I watched the show. I enjoyed the show. I was going to leave a review. But who fucking cares? Well, that's not nice. Every few years, when the lineup warrants it, I go to a metal, punk, and hardcore festival in Sydney called Soundwave. This week, they've made a third lineup announcement. Normally, I wouldn't care. If the bands were any good, they would have been announced in one of the first two announcements, right? Wrong. Soundwave has a new main event after Fucked Up were included in this week's announcement. Aww. I hope you aren't too early, Damien. Although, if you are, let us know. If you're the type that lingers among festival crowds afterwards, I'm bound to have some greenery to smoke.
I will definitely come find me. No, I last we've played Soundwave twice before, and they always put us in the graveyard shift going against the headliner. So if Pastors have been any indication, no, we will be very late into the day. But it's a
well, crazy, look out for Randy.
I will definitely look out for Randy. That's where I met Chris Jericho.
That's right.
We toured with Chris Jericho last time, and yeah, it's a great festival. Randy, come find me, friend. I will be around.
Okay, we've got two more here. We have Christian Small. Knowing that Damien is joining for you for this show, I will make this short, as I know you guys will do a great review. The show had its ups and downs, but I felt it was overall pretty good. It looked like Tiger Mask was going to commit suicide when he jumped randomly onto what looked like nothing. I really liked the Steiners match and the IWGP title match. I have a question for you guys. Who do you think had more names and gimmicks, Ed Leslie or Barry Darso? Both must be in the double digits. Oh, boy. I would say Ed Leslie off the top of my head because he had so many, from Dizzy Hogan, Brutus Beefcake, the man with no name, the booty man, the disciple.
I'm trying to think, who's added like the most gimmicks in wrestling of anyone?
Oh.
Because you've got five there? Six?
I mean, Brooklyn Brawler had a number. Bryan Adams had various variations of Crush. All over the place.
And even like, which Chris Jericho's had three?
Yeah,
I guess you count different personas in WWE's a lot.
Yeah, I see those as more just kind of...
extensions.
Yeah, like changes to the character rather than gimmicks. I wouldn't call Chris Jericho a gimmick, like a...
not like a barber.
A Repo Man.
That's
or
true.
Hole-in-One Barry Darso.
Maybe,
or Crusher Khrushchev.
Maybe, though...
Someone's going to list them. Barry Darso and Ed Leslie. Those would be the two go-tos, I would say.
For the most gimmicks. I'm inclined to agree.
And last one is from Ricky in Sacramento, California. I've always been a big fan of the Dome shows. My birthday is January the 4th. I'll agree that this show is a bit of a mixed bag with clear standouts in the talent pool. I love the Liger-Tiger Mask match, mainly because of the grand entrances. The Steiners versus Hase and Muto was another great match on the card. The stalling suplex to sit-down driver that Scott pulled off, yeah, the screwdriver, was just nasty. Really made the Japanese crowd pop. Hogan could actually work a Japanese-style... I wouldn't say he could necessarily work a Japanese-style match, but he...
Modified Japanese
He did what
style.
He had to do. I mean, for Hogan. Okay, he does qualify. It was decent, and the audience was hot for him. Shinya Hashimoto and Masachono told a good story and definitely showed strong style. The main event was okay, considering the age of the two men at this point in 94. With New Japan World available, I really hope you guys can... continue to dive into the library and do more reviews of pinnacle shows from New Japan's history. I would love to. I think, though, I have to realize that there's a limit to the length of some of these shows that we can watch in a given week. So 5-hour shows are probably not going to be reviewed in but maybe break up a Dome show over 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Maybe that is the better way to go.
I have one more question for you, John.
Oh, go for it.
Given the fact that wrestling and wrestlers are such a proven draw, and given the fact that all the headlines have been generated by CM Punk's moving over to UFC, do you see Bellator making a run at more WWE talent, big-name wrestling talent, to bring him over there?
Or
UFC, too. Now UFC's saying that they...
Bellator, definitely. I just question who's going to be out there that they could get.
Del Rio.
Del Rio's a possible... if that guy wants to fight at this point, I just...
Del Rio versus Punk would be... Well, I guess it wouldn't be the same weight class, right?
No, because Del Rio fought, I want to say, at like 220 pounds.
Okay, yeah.
So they wouldn't be fighting at the same weight.
50 pounds.
But nonetheless, I don't know if Del Rio necessarily wants to fight. He's got a pretty good deal right now.
Yeah.
With AAA, Lucha Underground is going to be calling, and any other promotion. I think TNA now, maybe they're going to want to... He's going to have a lot of options in wrestling that don't require you getting kicked in the head.
No, but I think a lot of these guys probably train, right, in their sidelines, right? And just like that now is another option, like which wasn't there.
I think Bellator, if there is any kind of name recognition, I don't think they're going to have any objections to going after anyone that brings an audience and eyeballs to them. That's their mandate in 2015. It's not searching gyms for necessarily the best fighters. Mm-hmm. You want to have that core group. You want to sign your Aaron Picos that might become tremendous fighters one day. But right now they're going for names. They're going for selling stories and bringing eyeballs to their product. It's very different when you're just doing big television fights. I think that's their goal. And I think if the right guy is out there, it's just a question if there are those guys that A, are available, and B, would be interested in fighting. That's the other thing.
Yeah, and one other thing then is if they are booking Punk's opponent, do you think they're going to go try and find someone from like a wrestling amateur, never fought before background, or are they going to try and find like a legit kind of like skill, equal skill level fighter that's coming in through UFC?
I think that they're going to, I think it's going to end up with someone that MMA fans at least know who they are, rather than plucking out a guy that they've never heard of before and putting it on pay-per-view. I think it's going to be someone that there's at least doubt that this guy will just beat Punk easily. But I think you're in a really tough position when this is on pay-per-view and
you might only have one shot at it.
Yeah,
he loses.
That's the other thing. It's that if Punk gets blown out, is there going to be interest to see him a second time? My gut says you're going to get two fights out of this guy, but who knows? I mean, who knows if this guy's going to last a fight camp? I think that's a huge question. I think that's completely reasonable to question if this guy can go through an entire mixed martial arts training camp, which is completely different from just training jiu-jitsu on your time off, to doing a full camp, full time, and your body holding up to that when it's got so many miles on it at this point, where his knees have been thrashed, where this guy has fractured a skull, where he's had concussions. I think it's a perfectly logical question to ask, is this guy even going to make it through a camp?
What about Sakuraba, bringing him? Because wasn't he the Gracie Hunter?
I don't think Sakuraba is going to be coming in. I don't want to see Sakuraba fight anymore. Okay. I really hope he just sticks to pro wrestling, because even that can be challenging. He's got his UWF match with Minoru Suzuki. That's the closest he might come
to fighting.
I know,
but this is like another Gracie he's got to hunt down and beat now. Another Gracie disciple.
I guess.
And a pro wrestling, you could. I think this is the one that, you know, appeals to both sides of the...
I think we're really widening what it considers to be a Gracie now, where you can just attend their school and train under Henner.
Hey, I'm you know, you got...
Will you watch that pay-per-view, though?
I think, you know, it's hard to say, because, like, I probably will. Like, if the opportunity presents itself, I probably would. I'd be more inclined to probably watch, you know, like, someone that was built up as, like, a new great champion in UFC than I would sort of a gimmicky.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, maybe it's going to be unbelievable. But I just, like, I look at this as being, like, this is going to be an uphill battle for anyone. Like, you're coming into a sport that people, like, have lived their whole lives to be good at. Like, this isn't 1990.
There's
six UFC or 94 UFC or whatever, like, the old days were. This is like now.
It depends what perspective you look at it. If you're simply looking at this from the perspective of the UFC, I think there's very little risk involved on the UFC side. My concern comes with if you're just simply looking at Punk's side of things.
Yeah.
He has the biggest task in the world, and the odds are heavily against him being successful at this.
Well, if it's a bad match, that's the end of CM Punk as the tough guy, right? Like right now.
I don't know. I don't know how people are going to take to that in terms of, you know, if he just comes in and he's blown out in 45 seconds and he looks terrible, maybe.
Like, imagine if Brock had lost that first, like, well, he did lose the first UFC fight. Imagine he never had a second one after that first one, where he's like, I remember watching the video, like early days of internet video, and they've got the ice on the back of his neck. And he's like, what happened out there? Like, asking. And that was like the last image you had of Brock Lesnar.
Yeah. Well,
I don't
think
he would have come back to WWE as Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, but you know what? Lesnar got blown out in that last fight by Overeem. That didn't hurt him at all. And maybe that's because he was successful in the UFC prior to the Overeem fight. But, you know, that first Frank Mir fight, what was so incredible about that is that everyone had this idea going in that, oh, if Brock loses, it's like, that's it. And that fight couldn't have turned out better for both involved. Brock Lesnar looked good. There was a plausible reason that had Steve Mazzagatti not called that blow to the back of the head, that Lesnar would have finished this guy. So you had this controversy, and Lesnar, I think, begrudgingly got respect from people that were naysayers towards this guy, where he fought well during that fight. They still wanted to see him fight afterwards, and it created an even bigger rematch. Like, that couldn't have worked out better. So I think if in this match, expectations are so low for this guy because of it, that if he shows any, you know, notable skills in this fight, I think people will applaud him for being able to do this in a short window of time, starting at scratch. However, It's like this idea that you can just become a tremendous fighter in 6 to 12 months.
Like a top level.
Like, I don't think you understand just how difficult it is to become an elite fighter, even against some guy that might be 1-0 that's been training for years.
Well, they would have gone and watched him train, right? They would have seen tape of him training. Like, because I just look at Batista was never given a UFC contract.
And no, Strikeforce though, they were close.
Yeah, Strikeforce,
using
but
him.
Like, but that was like that's almost like you know, I'm not a huge fan or anything, but that was almost like the Bellator of back then, right? Like that's a secondary organization that's a little more desperate than UFC. And,
well, Batista to me is the argument of if you're just looking from this from the business point of view. I mean, Batista was thrown out on a CES yeah. MMA show that pretty well nobody won. Like you had to really dig to find that match. And it wasn't a big deal when it happened. That Vince Lucero fight was just, it came and went, and it was a footnote. And Batista, if he were to have done that fight on Spike for Bellator, would have been a massive deal.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been way bigger than Bobby Lashley fighting on Bellator. I mean, Batista was a much, much bigger star than Bobby Lashley. He was, I think, comparable to, you know, a CM Punk fighting on free television. So it does matter where you have that fight. And CM Punk, I think they understand that. Like, this guy going out and fighting on a random Titan FC show is a waste.
Where'd you put it in the card? Like, where'd you put that match? It can't be your main event.
No, but I wouldn't put it as a main event, but I'd put it, you know, third fight on a pay-per-view where it's not – it's going to be the biggest focused on match, yeah. I think, in terms of interest going in. But you will have an actual main event. And
you couldn't put it on TV because I think the tune-out after that match would from the casual, like –
Well, I think the idea is that if we're going to do this, we know that there's a huge amount of people that are negative to this, but we'll still have curiosity, and even more so, there's a rabid audience that likes this idea, is curious to see it, and will pay to see this, and this might just be a disaster, this one fight, and we're going to make money off of it the first time.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it. I think it just opens the door because you have all these UFC shows, all these Bellator shows, that you're just like, let's just put this random wrestler who's willing to do this fight, kind of like celebrity boxing or even maybe Pride at the highest level type thing. And it's just like, you know.
Pride was built on stuff like this.
Yeah, and you were talking about Tough China and how there's like, you know, no one on that card. Like you throw, like, you know, Cesaro, like random name to throw out there, but he's like a physically strong person. I would buy that. I'd like, you know, I would never pay for just a random UFC China pay-per-view otherwise, but like all of a sudden you've got a wrestler on there. It's like, that's like intriguing to a certain segment.
They knew exactly what they were getting into when they made the deal. And more than anything, CM Punk understands all this. When I watched all those, the interviews he did over the weekend, I mean, here is a guy that completely understands why he's here, understands the business of this and the industry. This is not some guy going in just with his head empty about what he's walking into. This is a very intelligent dude that understands all of the complaints about this. And I have no doubt he's going to take this incredibly seriously. This isn't someone that just walked into a gym, said, oh, I could do this. I think he understands, like, the odds are against me making this work.
It's almost like he closed the door on one area of trolling criticism towards him. And, like, you know, I'm sure most of that wrestling criticism still keeps going on. But he closed it to some of it, and he just opened it to an entire new world of mixed martial arts criticism coming towards him.
Yeah, and he's
going to... On Twitter, he must just turn it off again.
I wouldn't even log on to something like that for the next year.
Oh, because he went back on it after going on Colt Cabana, but I would just be like...
It's my further belief that Twitter one day will be a thing of the past.
You think it'd be
I think from a certain level of people, I think once you're at a level like a CM Punk, what does Twitter do for you? Other than just, you can clearly tell that's a guy that even as maybe strong-minded as he may be, that criticism gets to him.
Oh, it gets to everyone.
I think anyone who says, oh, it's just comments, bullshit.
Yeah, because
there's days I'll read things and it fucking infuriates me.
No, like first thing you learn is not to read the comments. That's the very first thing you have to learn because it's just like people are monsters and people just want attention. A lot of time, it's not even valid criticism. You know, it's just like someone just saying like, and I know this because I was probably that dude. Thank God there wasn't comment sections when I was that guy. I would do zines about it instead. But I was that bad of a person. So.
Well, you know what? Every single person listening to this loved this show.
Well, I hope everyone loved it because I love doing it with you, John. Thank you for having me back on,
high
buddy.
High five.
Way, look what you missed, buddy.
He's not going to miss the next Tokyo Dome show.
Nope.
And he's not going to miss next week's show because WWE Network has posted three episodes of the infamous WWF Tuesday Night Titans show.
Oh.
And we are going to review the July 11th edition. Don't quote me on that. It's either June or July 11th of one of the three episodes they posted. But the key segment is Mr. Fuji doing a segment explaining Japanese customs that we are going to discuss. It's a two-hour show, so we are going to review that next week. Very different from the Tokyo Dome. We return to the WWF next week.
Sticking in a Japanese theme, though.
Very much so. It's a natural segue. So that's going to be our review next week, and then we'll be back later this week with all our regular shows at liveaudiowrestling.com. You can subscribe on iTunes. Once again, Damian Abraham will be at Woodbridge Heroes this coming Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, hosting Talk is Jericho with Chris Jericho, and we will have the details as well up at liveaudiowrestling.com in our daily update if you want to look that up. But it's Woodbridge Heroes,
mm-hmm,
and fan Q&A, autographs, lots of stuff to discuss. I'm looking forward
lots
to catching it out, checking it out.
Just read his new book, so lots of stuff to discuss.
Cool. So that's all for us. Left for Damian. And where can people find the podcast?
It turned out a punk. If you go to audioboom.com/turn-out-punk.
Oh, boy.
Or iTunes.com, turned out a punk. And or DamianAbraham.com. I got my own website now.
Oh, well, that's much easier. DamianAbraham.com.
Well, I want
for
to be, like,
everything.
There's some people, John, that are fast typers. They're like, okay, got it.
/, /, /.
Hey, it's for the comedy.
Page not found.
Definitely page not found. If page isn't found, blame John.
What's the song you've come up to go out with?
We're going to be ending with, oh, gosh, what Neurosis song should we go out with? This is always a hard part because, like, they don't really like the first record, but that was like the record I grew up on. Let's go with something of Pain of Mind. Just can't even. Let's see what's. This is people's favorite part of the show, John.
They love it.
You can cut.
They're in anticipation. No, we don't cut anything.
No, I know. Every time you say like, "Hey, we're going to cut this part," and I know you're lying to Wei, or you're lying to whoever you're saying they're going to cut that part because you don't cut that part. Yeah, let's end with. Self-taught infection.
That was going to be my pick.
Yeah, that's probably my, actually, I don't know what my favorite song on Pain of Mind is, but this is off, I believe, the very first Neurosis album.
All right. That's taking us out. We always appreciate it, Damian. It's always great catching up with you, chatting wrestling. He will be back at a future date, and we thank you for the time.
I will love coming here every time I can. Thank you to everyone that comes up to me and says, I enjoy you on The Law and MLW. It makes me feel better and definitely helps block out the people that write me on Twitter and say, never, ever, ever go back on The Law.
Or don't MLW. Listen to those people.
I know, but those are the ones you hear. I'm just like CM Punk. Those are the ones you hear.
They bought your house, Damian. Remember that. All right, we'll chat with you later on this week.